This episode of The Guild is brought to you by Creative Edge. Creative Edge specializes in getting exposure for independent writers and authors and artists of all type. They specialize in arranging events such as book signings, library or school presentations, or any event related to the arts in general. If you are interested in seeing what Creative Edge can do for you, go into www.creative-edge.services. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. My name is Chris Mary Holtman, and today we are talking to Secret Sky author J.P. McLean out of Canada. We have a very interesting talk about, you know, self-publishing versus traditional publishing, using a hybrid publisher to get your work out there in the first place, and a lot of that stuff. And there's a lot of good tips and tricks from JP that can be useful for an aspiring writer. Don't take my word for it. Let's listen for yourself. I'd like to welcome J.P. McLean to the Guild podcast. Welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Chris. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate being here.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. Tell me, how are things in your part of the world? I think it's been a while since I actually had a Canadian. No, P.L. Stewart was the last Canadian I had on, and he was just very, very bubbly and optimistic about everything. So it was very difficult to gauge what the situation was.
I'm on the West Coast on a small island, and it is absolutely gorgeous here today. I'm actually wearing shorts. It's very unusually and unseasonably warm. But we're locked down again due to COVID. Oh. The travel restrictions, they're getting quite tight. They've got people now. I think as of Friday, they're going to be at the major highways and ferries asking people if they're on essential business, because it's that bad. They need to cut things and shut things down a little bit. How is it there?
Well, here it's a weird situation here in Sweden, where I'm located, because we've never really been completely locked down, but we're also kind of suffering from that, and we've had like record high numbers. What they did was they shut down the schools. And then they tried to bring the schools back after the summer, and basically the numbers kind of elevated to even higher than they had been when they shut down the schools the first time. But now we're slowly bringing the kids back to school. We'll see what that does, because the numbers are not going down. They're still kind of like rising, although the people who are actually hospitalized intensive care hasn't risen. So that's good.
Well, that's good. That's good. What's your vaccination rate now?
I was asked that earlier today too. 7%.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not.
We're at, I think, 29% for Canada.
Yeah, so that's, I think what the states are on, like 15% in total vaccinations, but 50 or somewhere with the first shot. So
yeah, we'll see. Yeah, they're doing really well. They're doing well. It's nice to see because they're our neighbors to the south. So they're protected, we're protected.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting, this podcast will be partially a documentation of the whole lockdown situation, or at least this year that I've done it for 5 years, but this whole past year, this has been the standard question. How are things in your part of the world?
Yeah.
Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. I have an Irish author colleague that I do a lot of podcasts with, on a separate one. And I think they've been actually like locked down for an entire year, completely locked down. And
Another interesting aspect of this COVID is whether or not writers are going to be including the experience in their fiction.
Yeah, that is. I mean, and I asked people that kind of early on, and some, I mean, in different ways. It depends on what kind of fiction you have. My wife was talking about that before. It's like, will this be seen in like movies and TV shows? And especially the TV shows that are more, you know, realistic. Like you take a show like, say, like this era's Gilmore Girls, for instance, is that going to be part of a show like that?
Yeah.
And I don't know. What do you think? Would you include it?
You know, I've given some thought to it, and as far as I'm concerned right now, I'm going to steer away from it. And the only reason I want to do that is because I like to think of my work as escapism. Mm. And I don't really want to bring people back to a point where they're thinking about the lockdown again and wearing masks and social distancing. So it may not be realistic, but I think I'm going to steer clear of it. At least that's what I'm saying right now. I might experiment with a short story, including it, but for my long fiction, I think I'm going to leave it out. Mm. How about you?
Yeah, actually, and I'll get to that. I spoke to Dan Fogler a couple of years ago, and this was before the lockdown. And he's not an author. He does comic books, but he was talking about that. There are a few big events that will always impact writers of that generation. And he said, like, the Second World War was one of those. 9/11 for his generation and was one of those. It'll always be there. It'll always affect whatever you write. And no matter what you do, even if you don't mention it, it'll be there, the effects of it. To me, it was, I think, the storming of the Capitol. If you're American, that'll have a great impact on writing, writers that witness that. But I think globally, I think the pandemic will have some kind of effect. And I'm working on a I don't know what you'd call it. It's a crime noir, so a crime story, but it's set in kind of like an ambiguous future. So it's not really, it's the future, but things have kind of gone back to looking more like the 50s, the 40s and 50s, because there's been, and they reference it, but it's never really clear what has happened, but they reference that there was maybe like, that there's been an overthrow of power and that it's gone back to being more conservative. And that the government has taken away the internet, for instance, and stuff like that, so people can't communicate over the internet, which has made people kind of regress. And what I did do was that they don't shake hands when they greet each other anymore. They touch elbows, and that's just what people do.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a hint towards a pandemic.
Yeah.
But we'll see if I include any more. I've done it in a fantasy story that I wrote, A Sword and Sorcery. I did include it only as a plague that takes place in another part of the world.
I see.
Mention, but it's not part, but it's a mention that times are tough because. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. I mean, it's difficult, I think, to not, to, as I mentioned at another podcast too, was like, I mean, Tolkien could never get away from his, even if he wrote escapism, which he did, he could never get away from the First World War and his experiences in the First World War. It was very much part of, yeah, of his work. And I mean, even, I mean, you work, I'm a fantasy writer, you're a fantasy writer, and I think you just work it in there without, I mean, it was the same with C.S. Lewis, Narnia. The war is very present, yeah, in, yeah, his books. What, yeah, would you say is present in your books most of all, like, that has affected you, that is like, let's say, like, if we talk about escapism, we talk about fantasy and escaping to a different world or a different reality, but there's always our reality is always, something from our reality is always present that affects us. What would that be in your stories? What is your?
I set my stories in the present day. So even though they're fantasy, I set them very firmly in today. So, you know, I talk about cell phones and internet and the day-to-day things that people do. So it's very grounded in even neighborhoods. People recognize the neighborhoods because I mentioned streets and stores and landmarks that people are familiar with. So even though people can fly in this series, it's a secret world where people can fly and the regular people don't even know they exist. So I think that would be it.
Yeah. So it's basically the secret world or the hidden world, kind of like a Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, where there's a secret world that some people can tap into and some can't.
That's right. Yeah. Like a world within a world. It's a little more, it's just people don't see other people. When the people are flying, they do it at night. They have night vision. So they keep their flying to nighttime. And one of the things that is quite true about human behavior is people, when they're walking around during the day, very rarely look up. They look down or out, but they rarely look straight up. And I use that as an explanation in the story about how these people are able to remain secret. People just don't look up. And if they do look up and see something, you know, they'll blame it on having an extra glass of wine or, you know, a smudge on their glasses or their mind playing tricks on them. They won't immediately say, "Hey, look, there's someone up there flying."
No, and that's very, very true. I just did a podcast just before this with Christina Rienzi, and we talked about like what you don't perceive, and Terry Pratchett, one of my favorite authors, talked about that, is that the human mind is so wired that things that are unbelievable you can't see. People are never really invisible, or magic isn't really hidden. It's just that the human mind can't see it because it's not supposed to exist.
Yeah, or at least the adults don't see it, right?
Yeah.
I think I've heard some that kids are not yet programmed. Small children are not yet programmed. They may see things that we don't.
And there's a truth to that too, in as like when you talk about language, is that a child, that a newborn can hear every single sound in language, but is then taught to only hear the way, you know, if it's English, they can only hear, it's difficult to say. I would have to take Swedish as an example. In Swedish, a word can never end in an H sound. It's impossible. It doesn't exist in the Swedish language. But if you have a word, they did an experiment. They took a word that doesn't end in an H, but when they turned it around in the sound, they said it and they turned it around, and then it all of a sudden has an H in the beginning. There's a silent H at the end. And that's the human mind is programmed. So when people learn new languages, like people who have H very prevalent in their language, like people from the Middle East, they have a hard time speaking Swedish because to them, that word would have an H at the end. So they pronounce the H because they hear it.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating. So it's kind of like the same thing. So your books series, and I'm very fascinated in this, I'd like to ask you, Secret Sky is your urban fantasy series. What makes you write how did you plan to do a series, or was I've heard some people, like P.L. Stewart, who I said you're a Canadian author, he said that he has like the whole like 12 books planned, but he's written only the first one.
Wow. Well, that's impressive. No, I wrote Secret Sky thinking it would be a one-off, and it was more or less a challenge to myself to see if I could put together an idea big enough for a book. And lo and behold, 7 books later. But no, I finished the first book thinking I loved the world I'd created and the characters. I loved the setting. I thought it had tons of potential. And after I finished writing it, I really missed the characters. So I actually started outlining the second and third book, coming up with ideas for them. And almost as soon as the first book was out, I knew I had at least a trilogy. And it wasn't until I started accepting that new ideas would come to me. I was hoarding ideas for the longest time, thinking, oh, I better save that for book two or book three, because I don't want to run out of ideas. And then what I discovered during the course of writing the first three books was that the more I used my imagination, the more ideas kept coming to me, and I couldn't get enough ideas into the books. They were just coming in waves. So the ideas for the rest of the books came. And then when I got to the fourth book, I actually took a bit of a break and wrote the first book again. So I wrote a book called Lover Betrayed, and it is the first book, Secret Sky, written from a different character's perspective. So it starts prior to Secret Sky and ends later than Secret Sky. And it's the love interest story, the main character's love interest. So it's his story. And after I finished that, I went back and then I wrote books five and six. And six finishes the series off, but I've left some trap doors in there. So if I decide I want to continue writing it, there are some things that I can pick up and write again in that series, because there's potential for it to keep going. It's definitely got long series potential if I chose to do it, but I wanted to give the readers a break and an end if they wanted to finish it at that point.
So, I mean, are you working on something new then?
I am. I'm really excited. I have a brand new book, brand new series, set in the same place, because I love Vancouver. That's where I set my books, or, you know, fictional towns close to Vancouver. This next one is actually in Vancouver. And it's a different scenario entirely, but set in the present day. People don't fly in it, but there is a supernatural element. I don't think I could write a book without a supernatural element now. That was so much fun. Sky's the limit with that stuff.
Yeah, so they're not gonna overlap in any way. It's just that it's not that the main characters aren't looking up.
No, the main character in the new book doesn't fly, but she does have a very disfiguring birthmark that's wrapped around her body. And when the birthmark starts to disappear, she's elated because it's formed her life. It's turned her into the person she is, which is shy and withdrawn, and people point fingers at her and such. And so once this mark starts to disappear, she's absolutely elated until she delivers flowers one day to a professor out at the university, and he recognizes the mark as being a ritualistic mark. And the fact that it's disappearing is not a good thing, because it means that the protection that it affords her is going to be eroding as well. And so then she's in a race against time to find out who gave her the marks and what they're protecting her from.
I like that. It's a good plot. I it's interesting. I mean, I like that kind of. I think. I'm a big Lovecraft fan and M.R. James fan, and I think the whole idea of secret esoteric lore has always had some kind of fascination for me. So
yeah,
I like that stuff. But if we go back to Secret Sky, because now you kind of jumped ahead and what you're working on now, it's easy to be excited about those things. But Secret Sky, so what is the actual plot, apart from people being able to fly? What are we looking at story-wise?
In that story, through the whole series, the main protagonist is a woman named Emmeline Taylor. And when she starts out in Secret Sky, she doesn't actually even know she can fly. She just knows she's having a problem with gravity. It keeps leaving her, which is very awkward and uncomfortable and dangerous. And so she returns to her family's abandoned cottage on the West Coast to try to learn how to deal with this thing that she considers a nuisance. And she makes a mistake while she's trying to train herself and falls from the sky. And that fall puts her in the hospital. And that's sort of where the typical fantasy story takes over. So she, the doctor who treats her in the hospital recognizes the second lens in her eye that marks her as a flyer. And the flyer gene is a gene issue. So she learns there are others like her, and they teach her to fly. And that was tons of fun writing, you know, teaching someone to fly. And as she gets indoctrinated into their world, she realizes that they're keeping secrets from her, that flyers like her are going missing, and that powerful organizations know about them and are actively hunting them. So it's not all sweetness and light, this wonderful gift she has to be able to fly. And through the series, she runs into trouble throughout the series with people finding out about different members in her organization and her little group. And it gets quite dark at points. It's quite suspenseful. It's action packed. The flying scenes were just such fun to write. And it does have some dark scenes. And I think if I had to sum it up, I would say it's probably the overarching theme would be perseverance, you know, getting back up when you've been pushed down and making mistakes, but overcoming them and coming back stronger every time.
It reminds me a little bit about there used to be a Highlander TV show. Mm-hmm. If you remember the Adrian Paul, probably Canadian.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking Outlander. Sorry,
wrong one. Well, there is an Outlander TV show as well. No, Highlander. If you remember that old movie with Christophe Lambert.
I don't. Is it one I have to watch?
Yeah, you do. It's an urban fantasy. It's about people who are immortal. They die and then they come back to life and then they realize that they're immortal. And there's a certain group of people that are immortal. And they die if they lose their head, if their head gets chopped off. And all these people who are immortal, they have to battle each other till there's only one left. And the one that becomes left is the one that is supposed to shape the world, the future. So you don't want a bad guy, you want a good guy. And so that's kind of what it's about. Sean Connery was in both the first and the second one, I believe.
Wow. Yeah, I am going to have to go watch that.
Yeah. And there was a TV show, and I just remember that I mean, because obviously the Highlander, they're not called Highlanders. That's just the main character is from the Highlands. But I think people always refer to them as Highlanders, but they're not. But obviously it's a secret. You don't want people to know. But then there are people in the show, it's revealed that there are people that know and kind of like hunt these Highlanders. Or these people. But yeah, you should see it. It's the TV show. I don't even know if that's even if you can watch it anywhere. I don't know. Is there a Canadian Hulu?
It'll be on YouTube, won't it?
I don't know. Actually.
If it's not on YouTube, I mean, we have Netflix and Prime. We watch those.
Crave?
Prime, Amazon Prime.
Yeah, I don't know. But isn't there a Crave? What is Crave?
Oh, yes, we have Crave TV. Yeah, Crave TV. I don't have Crave, but we can get it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to look it up. I don't know. Anyway, Highlander. It's a good show. But it reminds me, and I think that's also very, I mean, I think you have, if you have, I mean, if you have people who are special and secret, then there must be people that know those secrets. I mean, it doesn't make any sense otherwise. I think in that now bear with me. I tired very quickly of Harry Potter. I only read the first three books because I felt I know where this series is going. I've read enough fantasy to know where this is going. But as I understand it, people in general don't know that there are wizards, right? So that that's a big mistake. How can people not realize that some people are running into this wall at the train station and disappearing. I mean, somebody has to see that at some point and try to investigate what that is all about. So I'm just thinking that that's kind of like a, because we talk about, I like to talk about believability, even in escapism, in fantasy. There has to be an air of believability, grounded in reality. What happened? So what did you think, when people fly, what did you feel was the biggest obstacle to make that believable? Because I assume that they're not just batting their arms and legs like swimming in the air.
No, it's a mutated gene. So I talk about it when I first introduced the concept. I have one of the people who can fly and has always flown, was raised that way, explain it to Emmalin Taylor. And the way they explain it is, and I got these examples right off of online. These are real examples. One of them is that aerodynamically, scientists couldn't figure out how a bumblebee could actually fly. And it wasn't until the 70s that they figured that out aerodynamically, how that worked. They just figured that it was impossible. It was scientifically at that point impossible. So that was one of the examples that I gave. And then I talk about the pyramids, how scientists didn't know how the people at that time could have made those monuments, built them. And they didn't think they had the tools at the time. So I turned it into a question mark that science just hasn't figured it out yet. That they'll work it out eventually, but right now they don't know. And right now it's safest that other people don't know about them. So I use that. I also have an organization called the Tribunal, and they are the judge, jury, and executioner of the flyer kind. So when flyers jeopardize their secrecy, and when they use their gift to dupe the real world, or to use it to steal money or something like that, the Tribunal will step in and actually kill the people that are doing that. They execute them. So there is a tight hand on what the flyers can do. And of course, Emmalin doesn't know any of that when she first learns about it. So that comes out over the series of books.
When you found the inspiration for this book series, I mean, where did you get it? The idea?
I dream of flying. I dream. It's a recurring dream I've had since I was a kid. It's the most fun I ever have dreaming. I hate waking up from those dreams. And when I, the woman jumping off a seaside deck and flying down the coast, and my internet connection is unstable. Am I okay?
You did break off, so you have to take it from, you were dreaming about flying, so you take it from there. You've always dreamt of flying.
Yes. And so I started writing that scene because I just wanted to capture the essence of that. And I would be home free to continue the series or continue writing that story. And so I did. And it starts off that the woman jumps off the deck. That scene actually isn't in the final book, but it prompted me to think, someone doesn't just jump off a deck. They must know they can fly. And if they know they can fly, then how did they get that ability? And how did they actually learn to fly? Because that would be a skill like walking or talking that you would need to learn. So it just gave me lots of fodder for the story.
And what other, I mean, were there, because I mean, urban fantasy, and I mean, these are young adult books, right? I'm correct in assuming that
these are adult books.
They're adult books, not young adult books.
They're not young adult. They're
okay, for good. Adult. Yeah. Good. Because you said that they were dark, and I was like, how dark can they get? And I was just, So I mean, what other authors in similar genres were you looking at this time?
Oh gosh. At the time I was reading Charlaine Harris's Sookie Stackhouse. So I mean, her Southern Vampire series. There are no vampires or werewolves in my series, but there's lots of magic type things happening. I was also reading J.R. Ward at the time, and she writes a series called The Black Dagger Brotherhood. And again, it's vampires, but both of those series are set in the here and now and hidden society. Well, Suki's is in a hidden society, but J.R. Ward's is. And I find that fascinating. I just like to think that there are people around us that can do these supernatural things.
Did you ever, I mean, the books are set in Canada. And I was thinking, like, and then that kind of lends itself to maybe looking at, I don't know, native lore and legends, or even, I don't know, Inuit, but that's farther north, probably. But I mean, did you ever look at anything of that, like that kind of lore?
I didn't. Right now, there is a, you know, I think we all have to be so sensitive right now to, appropriating native or indigenous cultures. So I didn't go into indigenous lore here. In the new book, I touch on some Peruvian lore, but a lot of it, they're more like artifacts that have stories attached to them rather than their cultural stories and their cultural beliefs. So there is nothing like that in Secret Sky. It's or in the series. It's all completely from my head imagination.
And that's fine. It's just, I don't know if there are any in you know Native American legends or stories about flying, but so.
Oh gosh, I bet you there are.
I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are.
Yeah, the eagle and crows and ravens, I'm sure. Yeah.
And how did, so publishing these books, how did that happen? How did you go about that and stuff like that? I think everybody's interested in hearing those everybody's publishing tale.
Well, with the first book, I was impatient and I was new to the business. And when I looked at the prospect of finding an agent and then agent selling it to a publisher and it would take 2 years, I thought, I'm not sure I want to go down that road. But I also was not very technically savvy. I didn't at that time have a Facebook account. I did very little online other than word processing because I used to teach word processing. So I was intimidated by the process of indie publishing. And I hired a publishing company who acted like a partner. So they did the cover, they did the formatting of the interior files, they set up all of the accounts with the various publishers so I wouldn't have to do that. And I pretty much just sat back and paid for those services and they put it up online. And I think I did the first first four books through them and was quite happy to be hands off and have someone else take care of all that stuff for me. But at one point when the next book was coming out, I decided, you know, it's time to bite the bullet and learn how to do this yourself. Mm. So I did. I ended up pulling the books back from the partner publisher that I had, who was Friesen Press. And created my own publishing house called Windstorm Press and put the books out through that company. And I outsourced the covers because I couldn't do that. And mm-hmm. I learned how to format the books. So I took some time to learn that and was able to do that on my own. And I still outsource the editing because I'm not, you know, I'm not capable of editing my own book anyway. So I outsource a major structural edit when the book is finished. And then after it's been through some beta reads, I then have it copy edited. So I don't do those bits myself.
And I think that's wise. I mean, there's so much to be done with covers and you know, having somebody do, you know, with a good eye, you know, create something for you. And I think it's also very special when you get the cover, you know, somebody is, after their interpretation of what you what you've you know, done. And I mean, you can have, I mean, I do some covers. I have, you know, done the covers for our publishing company that we have. And it's nice, but sometimes it's just way above what you can do. Oh, I mean, you have an idea and it's.
I actually, the cover that you see for Secret Sky, that's a new cover. The original cover, I had a very clear in my mind what I wanted the cover to look like. And I hired a graphic artist, very talented graphic artist, who did exactly what I was looking for. And I kind of learned, and I submitted that cover through Friesen Press. That wasn't something that... I mean, they gave me some advice on what font to use and that kind of thing. And they ended up, they put it together with the spine and everything, but the basic picture I sent to them. And what I learned through going through the process of putting it out through my own company was exactly what you've just said, is that there are people who know how to do book covers. They know what sells, they know what's popular in your genre, they know how to make a cover represent your genre and how to, you know, tell a story. In other words, with the picture. And the cover for Secret Sky, the company that did it is called JD&J, and they won me a first prize in the Kobo store for all of fantasy for the year it came out. So they did a good job, really good job.
I would say so.
Yeah, I'm very happy with that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Friesen Press was actually P.L. Stewart, the author that I mentioned, my Canadian author before you, he's with Friesen Press. But I mean, are they a high, are they a, what you would call a hybrid press then? It's like you do certain stuff for, and they do, they pay, you pay and they do a lot of the work.
They're a big and very well-established press in Canada. So they actually have a publishing arm, a traditional publishing arm, and then they have an indie publishing arm. So the indie publishing arm is where I went, and you pay for their services. So you pay them to format your book. So they just bring the experts together. Instead of, I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't even know where to look. So they bring all these experts together. You pay them, and they find the formatter to format your book. They're all in-house people because they're a publishing company. So they format the books, both the files for hardcovers, softbacks, and or paperbacks and eBooks. And then they set up the files, you know, with Amazon and with Kobo and all the other companies where you want to go. And you pick what you want. You know, you can choose just to do Amazon. You can choose to be more hands-on if you want to be more hands-on. You can choose to buy some bells and whistles that I didn't choose to buy, but some people do if they want them to do some marketing for them or some
like t-shirts and hats and stuff like that.
No, more you know, teaching you how to write a press release and teaching you, you know, how to reach your readers or how to identify who your readers might be and how to find your comparable books, that kind of thing.
And then there's a split, a royalty split or something like that, or do you get like
Yeah, there's a royalty. It's not as I can't remember what it is now. It's something like 55%. You know, or something like that. Whereas, you know, with Amazon, you get 70% if you price it above $2.99.
Still not bad for, you know, because most publishing companies will take 60% and you're left with 40%. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, it's better than a traditional deal for sure, but you also pay for the books. So, like you pay up front for the service and then the cost of the book is a little bit more, I think, than what you would pay. It's definitely more than what I pay now. And I go to an independent printer to print the books that I hand sell. And even my author copies from Ingram or Amazon are, or KDP, I should say, are less expensive than what I did pay from at Friesen. But that's part of the learning process. And it's part of, so I don't begrudge it one little bit.
I think Friesen is from what I understand is very good at what they do, and you get a good quality book. And I've seen people who have gone to real hybrid presses that get you know, pay a lot and get and kind of like an awful result.
Yeah.
I think those people are the ones, and you know, so it all depends on what you want to do. I mean, if you want to get your book out there, because I think you see a lot in author groups and stuff like that, people say is like, a publisher should always pay you. You should never pay them. Yeah. Well, that also might work if that's what you're looking to do in the first place, like make money. But then also, if you want to get your book out there, to get your name out there, then a place like Friesen might be the place to go, because you'll get a quality thing that you'll be proud of. And then if you don't want to continue with them, then you go out on your own. But at least you have a book out there that you can point to and say, you know, to another publisher that is going to pay you, say like, this is what I've done in the past. And if it looks nice, then you're in. So it's all depends. I don't look down on anybody who uses a hybrid or stuff like that, unless they haven't done their due diligence and see what they'll do for you. I mean,
I think you have to know what you're looking for. You can't go in expecting somebody else to just do the whole thing for you with you not having any concept of what they're doing. Because I think there is lots of potential for authors to lose a lot of money by going to the wrong company. And there are lots of places now where you can research. There's the Writer Beware blog at the Alliance of Independent Authors. There's a number of resources. So if you're looking at an independent press, a small press, or a partner publishing type of firm, I would strongly suggest they check them out first and make sure that there are no red flags out there, because there is a company called Author Solutions that has a terrible reputation amongst indie authors. And they have a lot of different names apparently that they go by. So I think it's important just to check to make sure that you're dealing with a reputable company before you hand over any money.
And it's also important to dig deeper, because I mean, I've experienced authors who assume things. They think that small presses have the funds and resources of a big publisher and get disappointed when their book doesn't show up in Walmart or whatever, and then lays that on the publisher and then reports them to these places. So I mean, there's a lot of things you need to be aware of, but you also need to see what you need to look at yourself too, and look what did you expect and what did you actually know.
And knowing the business is key. Really got to know the business, and that takes a little while to figure it out, what the roles are that everyone plays and how important things are, like how important editing is and how important your cover is. That stuff takes time to figure out.
And I think it's also important to not get lured into when somebody in a group says, you know, do you need a cover? Private message me. And then you get caught in like a loop of somebody who doesn't really, I mean, because aesthetics are so different. And I think a lot of people who think that they make great covers because that's what they think looks good, then it might not be what a cover should be looking like, but there's so much to learn. So Winterstorm Press, right?
Windstorm Press.
Yes. There's a publisher called Summerstorm Press. That's why. But Windstorm Press. Do you do anything other than your own books, or is it strictly?
Yeah, not at this point. I'm set up to do that. You know, it is a proper business, but right now, I just, honest to God, don't have the time. I'm just absolutely running full on with what I'm doing, and I do this full time. So, you know, I'm writing every day and I'm stuff in the afternoon, and it takes commitment to take on someone else's project. And yes, now I just don't have it. So I could, like, at one point, if I'm not doing my own books, I may take on somebody else's. I'd like to keep it within the same family, the same genre, but, but yeah, right now it's just not enough hours in the day, I'm afraid.
There's not. You need to sleep as well. I think that is so true. You can't spread yourself thin. I as I kind of mentioned before is that I run a press together with two other guys, and I mean there's three of us, so that does do help a lot. But it was still, you know, it's your own writing. You want to submit to do a bunch of short story calls because you want to get your name out there. Day job. I mean, I have a day job, so it. I mean, it does. There's a lot of things to think about, and you kind of have to weigh in what is worth what what is worth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like you say, you got to sleep too.
You got to sleep.
Quality of life, real important.
Yeah, you can hang out with your kids as well. So at some point, even if my kids are turning into teenagers and they're kind of like doing their own thing, but luck being that they are not allowed to go out and hang out with their friends.
Yeah,
they're forced to hang out here. So.
Yeah,
but so is your book like your books, are they available worldwide or just Amazon or?
No, they're available worldwide. You can order them through bookstores, and you can pick them up in Barnes & Noble, Kobo. Draft Digital has a number of different services. So they're on Folio, Inscribed, Walmart. You can order them through Walmart.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I know that it takes a while for the books to actually show up at Walmart, but you can definitely get books at Walmart. Yeah. Have you been able to get your books on shelves? Because I've understood that some authors have been able to do it, like for Barnes & Noble, for instance, that there's like a program through Barnes & Noble that you can get your books on it, local at least, I don't know.
Yeah. Have you? I find that the only way I can physically get my books in stores is typically to go and visit the stores, maybe do a book signing, and then they'll carry the books. Most bookstores are too small for the number of books that are out there. So they typically, if you're a local author, they will carry you. You do have to usually go and ask. And if you aren't local, like you can go in and order the book from any chapter store or any other bookstore you go into, because it's available through the Ingram Book Group, which is where a lot of bookstores order their books through. They're also in libraries. I made a point of getting my books into libraries, and Canadian libraries are very good about bringing in Canadian writers. If anyone goes and asks them to get the book, they'll order it. So I've got books in the libraries. But in order to get into the stores, you pretty much have to do something for the store, because there are just so many books coming out that they can't put all the books on the shelves. Yeah. And I mean, it's not one of the super best sellers. It's certainly not at the level that Charlene Harris, for example, would be at. But maybe one of these days.
You'll get there. We'll get there. Have you noticed a difference in sales since the pandemic at all? I mean, has that, because a lot of people say, like, you see a lot of people saying a lot of different things online, obviously. And somebody was saying the other day, is like, books just aren't selling. Does somebody want to buy my books? Books aren't selling because of the pandemic. And I'm feeling like, could that really be true? Because you think that people would read more.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a time last year, September, October, November, where I was selling ebooks more than two a day, which was really good. Mm-hmm. But it petered out again in January. So it's slowed down again. And last year, or again, it wasn't last year, now it was 2 years ago, I was doing a lot of hand selling during the summer. And of course, I did none of that last year. No Christmas markets, no summer markets where I would normally, you know, set up a tent and bring people in to have a seat and chat books. So I didn't get a chance to do that. So my paper book sales are down. My ebook sales are up. But I also find with ebook sales, you really do have to do some proactive either advertising or promotion to get people to see your books, because there are so many books out there. Yeah. So I think if you put the effort in, you will get the sales for sure. Ebooks better than print books right now, for me anyway.
Yeah, I think that definitely varies from place to place. Here in Sweden, where I'm at, the ebooks haven't really taken off because Amazon just came in January. So I mean, there hasn't been an Amazon, Swedish Amazon store. And to be honest, the Swedish Amazon store is horrible because all they've done is Google translated everything. It's like, yeah, they've had a really rough go of it here in Sweden because it's just been a mess.
Oh, that's too bad. That's too bad.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff is still comes like from Germany. They don't have like their own warehouse in Sweden either. Everything is like imported from somewhere else. Mm. So I mean, the Kindle has never really been a thing here.
Is the Kobo a thing there?
No.
No.
There's no Kobo. There is no Nook. There's no Literati, I think, was one thing that existed once upon a time. I think my father-in-law had a Literati. I don't know what company that was. But none of those. There has been a form of e-reader that there's an online bookstore here that's called Adlibris, which exists in other forms as well in other countries. And I think they do have something, but people don't read them. And people don't read on their phones because it's too small. And so audiobooks are really big here though.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of there's like BookBeat, because obviously, again, Audible isn't really a thing here, but there are other places like there's BookBeat and there's some other things where you buy a membership and you can just stream them.
Nice.
So a lot of people do that. But it's also, then it ends up being a lot of Swedish books because it's too expensive to buy a licensing for an English book. So
yeah,
that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
We'll see where that goes. And some people here in Sweden, interesting indie authors, will just release in audiobook and won't release a physical copy.
Really?
My neighbor across the street, he released a crime novel only in an audio form.
Oh, that's fascinating. I haven't heard of that before.
No, I was really surprised at that too.
I mean, because they have to write it, right? Anyway, yeah. So
there is a physical copy somewhere.
You would think that's a lot to memorize.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
Yeah. No, but I think there are companies that do that. That's all they do. They'll only pay they'll only publish audio versions. I'm guessing. I don't know how it would work otherwise.
Yeah, mine aren't in audio. I did look into it, not having the setup myself to do it myself, and not having the skill to do it myself. I would hire someone to do it, and the cost is prohibitive. It's not for one book. Like if I was to put one book out, I think it would be about $3,000 to $5,000 Canadian for one book. To produce it, like to have it, to pay for it. But I've got seven. So, you know, a lot of money, like $21,000. And you can't just do one because somebody wants the series, you know, they're going to listen to one and then be upset that they can't get two, and you don't want to upset the readers. So until I win the lotto, I probably won't. them out.
Or Netflix picks up your books as a show.
Ooh, wouldn't that be nice? Oh, that would be nice. You go ahead and make that suggestion. I'll be okay.
I'll call Netflix and
tell them. There you go. The Netflix goddess. Yes.
Yes. Or Crave, maybe.
I'll be signing on the dotted line.
Yeah, I don't know. I do watch some Canadian shows. I like Schitt's Creek. My wife and I watch it over and over again. Actually, we love it so much. And Letterkenny, which is on Crave TV, but it's a little bit raunchier. It's kind of like it's like a crazier version of Trailer Park Boys.
I'm not familiar with it, but I am familiar with Schitt's Creek because I just I binged watched it a couple of years ago. It's hilarious. Yeah. It's so funny.
I know. Yeah. I know. I love it. My wife loves it, and we show it to the kids every once in a while to show an episode here and there. And it works. I mean, it's good. And it's really of the time. We were talking before about like stuff being of the time, connected to the time. And I think it is because the kids are so, I mean, to them, like the stereotypes and the conservative part of like the old guard, it doesn't bother them. To them, it's just kind of like self-evident that people are gender fluid. I mean, it's not a thing. And I think that's kind of funny because they don't make a thing of it. I mean, Ovid, my daughter, is very, you know, conscious of the LGBTQ plus question mark society. She even started a group in school, in her school, about for that and equality, and she's very pro and she's very in your face about it, you know, just like vegetarians were in the beginning. I just wish everybody would stop eating meat, stuff like that. I remember it's like, oh, okay, well, okay, doesn't really work. But I mean, I think that was so refreshing in Schitt's Creek that the kids there weren't like that. For them, it was just like, you know, that's what the world is today.
Yeah, it's so refreshing. Yeah, very much so. I love it.
Well, JP, our time together is up, but it's been a joy to talk to you and hear about your book and your ideas and your adventures in publishing.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Chris. Really, really appreciate you having me on. It's been fun. And
if people want to connect with you, we already said that your books are available worldwide, yes. So there's no excuse to go pick them up. I always try to say, like, well, I mean, but my books are available on Amazon because that's usually what people know. But I said, like, but please go to bookdepositorybookshop.org. You know,
you can find it anywhere. Support. And my website is jpmclainauthor.com. And that is my hub. So that's where you'll find all the links to all the books. And you can read a little bit about it and see if it's something you might enjoy. I also put the first chapter up there for download for all the books. So if they want to download the first chapter in a PDF, they can do that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, as I said, it's been a joy talking to you. And I hope we can talk again sometime.
Terrific. I'd like that. Thanks very much, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you.
You can go have a good night.
You too. And we're back. I would like to take this opportunity to thank JP McLean for coming on. It was such a fun talk, and we even talked a little bit after the interview off camera, and that was kind of cool. But yeah, check her out. Check out whatever she's doing. Go to her website. The address is in the show notes. I'd also like to thank John Hoffman for providing the music. Thank you for listening. Remember, give us a follow, give us a retweet, a review, whatever you can do to help us with the algorithm. Also go check out the sponsor, Creative Edge, for any marketing need you might have. Well, thank you very much for stopping by, and I'll talk to you next time.